Oh, okay. Sorry. It's
about the we didn't have any members anyway, so.
Oh, can't have enough of them.
Nope. And you're going to need to clean up, so that's why they work.
Say, Donovan, what are we going to do with the Senator Estes?
Is she not nursing?
We'll call the Senate Tax Committee to order for April 15th, 2015. And this morning we'll start with Senator Anderson. Good morning, Senator.
Morning, Mr. Chairman.
Morning. And do you have an A1 amendment that you need put on your bill in order to get it the shape you'd like?
Yes, Mr. Chair. A1 amendment is a technical change to get the bill in the form that
Senator St. John moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. A1's adopted. Senator Anderson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members, Senate File 1922 is here to deal with a sales tax exemption for certain designated annual city celebrations effective for sales and purchases made after June 30th, 2015. The bill also provides amnesty for qualifying nonprofit organizations that organized and operated a city celebration on behalf of a group of nonprofit organizations effective of the day following final enactment. There are two sections in the bill. First section exempts goods and services sold at admissions at a city designated annual city celebration, and the second one is providing tax amnesty. I have with me this morning two members from the city of Delano who are on either side of me, and they are here to testify on behalf of the bill that has been heard in the other body. And I'd like to allow Mr. Rozier and Mr. Lynch to testify on behalf of the bill.
Welcome this morning, Mr. Rozier.
Thank you for having us.
Please state your name for the record and continue.
My name is Alex Rozier, R-O-E-S-E-R, and I am the current chair of the Delano 4th of July celebration.
And what can you tell us about the need for this, and what is the conditions going on with regard to the amnesty request?
We run a town celebration, and as we thought, we were meeting all of our guidelines to not pay sales and use tax. We found out after the fact, after an audit, that because we have a couple of our organizations that receive funds from our event, our 501c4s, that we now owe sales tax on all of our proceeds that go out to all of the different groups that we fund throughout the course of a year. In our town celebration, like many celebrations across the state, our town celebration raises money that goes out to, in our particular case, 29 to 37 different groups every year, from the food shelf to Dollars for Scholars to youth baseball, softball, to girls swimming, to all kinds of different things that we raise money for out of our town event. And what we found this out, we thought we were meeting all the laws. We were then audited, and we now owe a large sum of money. Actually, $38,000 was our tax bill, which unfortunately we don't have because we run the town celebration and we give all the money out. We found this out after the fact. And as we take a look, not just at our event as the 4th of July, we take a look at other town events across the state, whether that's Montrose Days or Looney Days in Vergas or Barnesville Potato Days or any of the other great events that every town runs. Anybody that has a 501c4, like the Chamber of Commerce, which almost every one of our small local towns has, that is probably somehow, way, shape, or form involved in their town celebration, that would make all of these events have to pay sales and use tax. So, you know, we contact our legislators, and we have the bill that's here before you today that we're hoping will kind of rectify that and clean that matter up, not just for us, but for so many other towns across the state. I don't think it was the legislature's intent ever to tax the town celebrations across the state. I mean, we have so many different community events that, quite honestly, you know, are our community events. They bring us together. They're volunteers that do a great deal of good work in our communities throughout the course of the year. And I don't think that was ever the intent of the legislature to tax all those things. And I think this is one of those things that just kind of happened, and we're hoping that this bill kind of fixes that and solves that for everybody.
And Mr. Rausch, what drove the problem then was the organizations that you were giving the proceeds to were not considered a nonprofit because of their tax classification. They were 501 something else.
Exactly, yes. They were 501c4s, like the Chamber of Commerce type of thing. We had that in one of our other organizations. Sportsman's Club, Athletic Club were fours instead of threes. Not to mention, you know, any donations back to our own city to do park fixes or playground equipment or anything else like that also make the event non-exempt as well. Even giving money to our local fire department for safety equipment or for doing upgrades there for turnout gear or something like that would have makes our event non-exempt. And you know, it's troublesome, but I don't want any other chairs of any other celebrations to go through what we've gone through over the last 2 years with the audit. It's been kind of a challenge. I do want to pat the revenue department on the back, though. They've been very wonderful working with us and explaining everything to us and trying to offer recommendations and anything that we, you know, anything they could do to try to help us. They've been fantastic working with us. But, you know, once again, this is what's on the books, so this is what has to happen.
And Senator Anderson, and we can hear from your other testifier in just a minute, but this is not the first time organizations that do work for communities have been here with sales tax issues. It's the forgiveness part of it is problematic. We've struggled with that in the past. It's not a good precedent to be setting. So I don't know exactly how the current tax bill can be resolved. The other thing I would like to mention is 501c3s in and of themselves do not have a blanket exemption because some of what their purchases are currently are taxable. Now, Senator Rest has a bill this year that would fix that, but that's not been enacted yet either. So we'll kind of have to work through this. Members, you remember the issues of last year with the dogs and cats and the Farm America. So we've struggled with this issue before. I don't today have an answer for you, but let's hear from Mr. Lynch, and then we'll continue to visit here. Mr. Lynch.
Yes, and I'm the past chairman. I understand where you're coming from. I guess if you take and look at, like, the Sportsman's Club as a C4, they give out money to the fishing for kids. They send kids to the Four Corn Clubs. I mean, the vast majority, just about everything that they do, goes to other nonprofits. It's for educational purposes, whether it's gun safety for kids. Legion Club, Legionville, it's for all veterans. We're not giving money for lobbyists or anything like that. So in our event is free. When they come into our town, they come down to the park, it's free. We don't charge anybody at a gate or anything. Our fireworks are free because it is Independence Day. So I think it's pretty unique in that we don't charge anybody. I mean, we're not out there to make a bundle of money. All our proceeds get turned around and given back to the community. The school gets a lot of our money, the schools, 4-H. So we were here probably, we weren't exactly here, but maybe 10 years ago. And before that, our festival ran, we'd run it anywhere from 5 to 8 days, depending on what day the 4th of July fell in. We went through this, and at that time they told us, if your event stays 4 days or less, you aren't going to have to worry about taxes. So 2 years ago, we come back, and then all of a sudden, bam, here you are. No, you got to pay taxes. So I guess for me, it's a little confusing. We thought we had it fixed at one time. And so we knocked it down to the 4 days to try to keep everything in the up and up. And then all of a sudden, $38,000 later, they're saying, no, you do have to pay taxes on that. And it is very confusing, very confusing. All these people are volunteers, whether it's in Delano, Montrose, Litchfield, up north, they're all volunteers. We shouldn't have to go and hire accountants for a 2 or 3 day celebration. You got a group of 6 organizations in Delano. We take and get all the money in. We split it up and give it to them. We don't babysit them and tell them this is exactly where it's got to go. But that's where it's going. It's going back into the community. We're not. There's nobody here getting paid to do anything. We're just trying to help other groups, whether it's to bring kids down to the Capitol for a tour. We'll donate money to that. You know, that's where we're all about. Nobody's pocketing any money or anything like that. So that's all I guess I got to say.
Well, we appreciate the good work you do, Mr. Lynch.
Thank you.
Senator Gazalka.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. More comments, I think, than questions. I've lived in a small town, a town under 2,000, and the fact is you just don't have the expertise to take care of everything. And, I see the intent of the bill. Hopefully, for sure, moving forward, we try to do something. It is difficult at times to go back in the past, but if we gave into the House on dogs and cats, anything's possible. So, but I really appreciate you bringing this up. I know the kind of work that you guys do and is much appreciated. It makes a town feel like home to a lot of people when you do the things you do. So thank you.
And Senator Gazalka and Senator Anderson, part of the resolution we accomplished last year for the bill that's due was to go to the Finance Committee and get an appropriation. And Senator Rosen worked on that with Senator Cohen last year for her organization, and it's a relatively small amount. I know they're working. I don't know if you serve on finance.
Yes, Senator. I do.
Maybe you would want to talk to Senator Cohen.
Yes.
About the bill that's due, and going forward, the tax committee can perhaps figure out a way to deal with some of this. But the past due stuff, we struggle with it. It's better,
sure,
if you can find an appropriation for that. And I'll mention it to him again that we have a comparable situation to what we had last year with Senator Rosen, and see if we can figure something out. Ms. Paula.
Mr. Chair and members, I believe Senator Rosen's bill ended up as a voluntary compliance program, and the Farm America issue was the one that was appropriated from the Finance Committee.
Yeah, it was Farm America.
Okay.
Yeah. Anything else, members? Senator Sanjan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and perhaps to any one of the witnesses, is this, just so I understand, is this about, for instance, a 501c3 organization running a celebration and giving money to a C4, or is that as simple as it is?
We don't designate.
Mr. Lynch.
I'm sorry.
Mr. Lynch.
We don't designate directly. We don't look at a group like, say, the
sure.
school, for instance. What are you? Are you a 501c3? We don't look at that.
Sure.
I mean, we have kids coming to us all the time during the year. Or a veterans organization that comes in and asks us for a donation. We don't, I guess, it probably not the knowledge. We've never asked anybody.
Chair, maybe I should ask
Senator Sanders,
perhaps even Senator. If it was a C3 giving to a C3, everything's fine? Is that the way it works?
Senator Sanjam, and we'll turn to Ms. Pollock. I think, you know, if Senator Rest's bill passes, then they will have a blanket exemption. Currently, they do not have a blanket exemption.
Okay.
Much of what they do is exempt. I think the difficulty here was the C3 was giving money to a C4,
okay,
so they didn't have the correct nonprofit category.
I Mr. Chair, I can almost imagine that is happening a lot of places across Minnesota.
You can see the examples, can't you?
Well, that's why, excuse
me. Mr. Rosen or Mr. Lynch?
That's why we thought when we were here the last time and when I was working with Mr. Emmer at the time when he was down here, that we'd try to keep the days under four to try to clean it up that way, in that it would make it easier. Because, I mean, you got the Aquatennial that runs for 2 to 3 weeks, and you'd have people coming out of the woodwork looking for that. So we thought by keeping it under the 4 days, because that's what most small-town organizations do, 3 or 4 days, that's about it. And then, like I said, we don't ask. We get a lot of people asking for donations, and we just, quite frankly, we don't ask them, well, are you a 501c3? Can we give you something legally? Each organization looks at each individual that comes to them and asks for a donation. It's up to them to donate. We don't dictate that, the 4th of July itself.
Sure. And Mr. Lynch, you know, hopefully as this legislative session moves along, we're able to fix that. But if we're not, you'll have to start being more careful about this into the future.
Sure.
And Senator Anderson, let me encourage you to try to get the past money dealt with in finance. It's just a much cleaner process, a relatively small amount, and see what we can do there. Senator Anderson.
And Mr. Chair, I just like to reiterate the fact that these people are volunteers, and they're trying to do this, and then when they get socked with an audit, it takes away from their livelihood to have to be a part of this whole thing, and all of a sudden you're seeing volunteers back off, and it's tough to get volunteers to be a part of these celebrations and within small towns.
Yeah, Mr. Rosen.
And if I may continue on with Mr. Anderson's line of thought here, when we went through the process and we went through the audit, we went through the appeals process, and we came to the compromise section, the paperwork we had to fill out for compromise to try to rectify our situation with what we had, you know, one of the things in the forms, and I will not tell my general committee what we had to fill out for that compromise, which asked for any state licenses and all the state license me or anybody on the executive board have. And I took that, and after talking with the revenue department, yes, they wanted to know any other state licenses that we, the volunteers that run this board, had, for very obvious reasons. I won't tell this to my general membership because I'm so scared that if I have volunteers that know that they may be held personally accountable or may have to do that and affect their livelihoods, I may lose a truckload of volunteers. For me, I'm not as worried about the amnesty. We'll figure some way to make it and get it done. It's not going to be easy. It's going to be very stressful. It's going to be hard. But I am more concerned about what this bill does long-term, about cleaning this up for all of our town celebrations across the state. I'm not going to be the only chair that's going to be filling this stuff out and doing this as the law currently stands. I really hope that there is some way that you guys can find a way to fix it, because I, you know, the stress that goes on this and what it does to volunteers, the complexity of, geez, I want to do a fundraiser to raise money for this, that, or the other thing, for my kids or whatever, or for veterans or something like that. It's becoming too complex to be a volunteer. We're going to lose our volunteerism, and that's my biggest concern.
Thank you. Anything else, Senator Anderson?
No, I appreciate your consideration.
Senator Sanger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to point out on line 19, I think there's, and we don't need to solve it here, but some ambiguity that could arise. When it says a city-designated annual celebration, I guess annual and a means one. I don't know if that's the intent, but you know, is it, I could, and is it city council required by resolution to designate that and so on and so forth? If this goes forward, I think we need to kind of look at those words and make sure they're what we want.
Ms. Pollack.
Mr. Chair and Senator Sengem, the
happen?
Beginning on line 1.12, as you referenced, the governing board of the city must designate one and only one event as the annual city celebration.
Done deal. Thank you.
Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on Senate File 1922? Seeing none, thank you, Senator Anderson. Thank you, gentlemen. Thank you for traveling. We'll take a look at this and see what we can do. And I would work in the Finance Committee on the payment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I will do that. And thank you, members.
Chair will lay Senate File 1922 over as amended for possible inclusion. Senator Rest. Senator Rest has the A1 amendment to Senate File 1678. It's a delete everything author's amendment.
Yes, sir.
Senator Rest moves the A1 amendment. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. Motion prevails. Amendment's adopted. Senator Rest.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman and members. Senate File 1678 is a proposal to ask the Department of Revenue to explore various methods for and avenues for Minnesota taxpayers, income taxpayers, to free file electronically. Right now, there are opportunities through several vendors for that to happen, software vendors. But it is. But that is a. But it's income limited or the type of taxpayer. For example, some services will provide that a taxpayer with $30-some thousand adjusted gross income. A lower income taxpayer then would be able to free file. Military, members of the military can free file. And I think there's at least another category. Oh, yes, those that are eligible and receive the earned income tax credit. But there is not. There's not an easy way of doing that for most taxpayers, and even with the Minnesota one, you have to go to their port in order to provide the information for free filing. And this early this winter, a constituent contacted me about with the question, how come I can free file with the service that I use, the vendor I use, my federal return, but I can't do it with Minnesota? I have to pay the vendor some sort of fee, $15, $30. Why is that, and why is that service not available to people who are filing a Minnesota return? I thought, good question. We should come up with an answer. And the answer is in the amendment, which is, again, to ask the department to conduct a study and to determine how we could go about doing that with the vendors that currently Minnesota taxpayers are most familiar using. Why should the state eventually, and there is an appropriation, and I'll offer that amendment in just in a moment, $175,000 for them to be able to do this work, to find out, to lay the groundwork. Why is that a benefit to the state? Well, and why should the taxpayers pay to have free filing? I mean, as a group, the state pay for it. The benefits are the ease of administration. It is a benefit to it's far more efficient when a return is filed electronically rather than on paper. Even when taxpayers go to a state's port to then enter information on a PDF form, there is a high rate of error. And so I believe that the actual cost eventually, I'm hoping that will be the case at least, the cost is going to be far outweighed by the benefits that we receive in accuracy, in ease of administration, in the fact that the department employees will not be handling reams of paper and having to check through paper. It will all be done electronically. As you may know, right now, paid preparers must file the returns that they prepare electronically unless they have a specific instruction from a taxpayer that they do not want their return filed electronically. And there's a reason for that, obviously, and it's the same reason, that it increases the efficiency, it cuts down on errors, because most software programs take you through a menu of steps to get to what your tax liability is. And, you know, there, if you do this yourself or you know or your preparer does, you can pay your liability straight from your checking account on the date that you desire, and or you can have any refund that's due to you done in the same way. It's efficient both for the taxpayer and for the Department of Revenue. Why is the federal a free file system and not the states? Well, it's because the vendors have service millions of customers, taxpayers across the country, and they have an agreement. They have a contract with the federal government who has that contract for the exact same reasons. Now, there are some states that do have free filing for taxpayers beyond the ones that are income limited, that get their earned income tax credit, or that are members of the military. But I think it's time for Minnesota to move in that direction as well. We would be asking for the study to come back in 2016 and with the hope that the report would indicate that we could start it for tax year 2017. We're trying to be very cautious about this because we do not want glitches in online systems. We've seen enough of that, and so we're trying to be very careful in getting a report from the department, which will be talking with the various vendors, et cetera, and getting as much information from the preparing groups as well as the commercial vendors. And I was very pleased after I put the bill in that the Department of Revenue contacted me and said that they were definitely interested in this project, and the director, I'm not exactly sure what your title is, but the director of the individual income tax in particular has helped draft the legislation in the Delete Everything amendment that you have before us. But I would like to go ahead at this point before you call on her and move the amendment that inserts the appropriation of $175,000 to do the work.
Do we need to pass that out?
I think it's in the folders.
It's in the folders, members. I'm not finding mine.
There is a... It's the fiscal note,
oh,
and
I
do have to tell you that
we just need to fill in the appropriation line on
yes.
Section 2.
I don't have my folder open because I left my glasses at home and I can't see.
Senator Ress moves on the A1 amendment that was adopted. Page 1, line 30, add in the blank $175,000.
Yes, sir.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Gazelker.
Thank you. I do have a question, Senator Rest, about that. First of all, I like the idea. But before I make my comment, do any other states already do this?
Senator Rest.
Mr. Chairman, we could call on my witness to respond to that. She has much more detailed information about what goes on in other states, and also the department itself, I think, worked with the preparation of the fiscal note. And it is an author's amendment, but I'm certainly happy to have it discussed before we act on it.
Sure.
It doesn't matter to me.
Sure. Ms. Steinbach.
Mr. Chair, members, for the record, my name is Terry Steinbach, and I'm the Assistant Commissioner of Individual Taxes at the Department of Revenue. Senator Gazelka, in reference to your question, there are states that offer solutions. And when I get into testifying, I'll talk a little bit about those solutions and what taxpayers are looking for. Most of the states that offer a solution offer something where it's very limited, if it's a simple return, or it's a situation where the taxpayer is simply filling out a PDF and then uploading it. So what we would be pursuing here would be something that I think based on our meetings with taxpayers, would meet taxpayer needs a little bit more than what other states are currently doing.
Because it's an author's amendment, I'll wait for my comment till after we adopt it.
Any more questions on the appropriation, members?
Oh, Mr. Chair.
Senator Nelson.
I do have a question on the appropriation. The delete all amendment just says $175,000 for fiscal year 16. But the fiscal note shows that it's an ongoing appropriation in the next biennium for $2.17 million. So I guess I have a question on the fiscal note.
That's
and
FTEs.
The amount. Oh,
FTEs. That's FTEs.
Thank you. This makes okay. I do have my glasses.
$2 million, man.
I
would really get a good
worried.
System, Mr. Chairman, Senator Nelson.
I have no question about the appropriation.
$175,000 one-time cost for a study. All those in favor say aye.
Aye.
Opposed, same sign. The amendment's adopted.
And Mr. Chair, if I can
Senator Gazelka.
Part of the reason I wanted to talk a little bit about this is I been thinking more about FTEs on a regular basis. Senator Metzen actually has helped me challenge some of these, but we're talking about over 4,000 hours of work to do some of the things you're talking about here. And I looked on the fiscal note and talks about having a tax specialist principal will be needed for 11 months to develop the request for information. 0.75 for two positions will be needed to provide assistance with the development of the report, and 0.5 for somebody that will be responsible in helping the vendors understand what we're looking for. And I'm just thinking that's a lot of hours of work for the thing that we're trying to do. And if other states are already doing something, I'm just thinking over 4,000 hours of work on this project seems like a lot of work. To me, that seems like a large number of hours that we need just to do this simple project, and I would like your comment on that.
Ms. Steinbach.
Mr. Chair, Senator Gazelka, we are asking for one full-time position, and it's more than just issuing. So in the process of issuing a request for information, we have to develop all the things that we're looking for so that the vendors can respond to that. In addition to that, we also want to research other options so that we can come back to you with a comprehensive report that talks about, here's the options that are available. Going with the vendor may be one option. There's other options that may be out there. So this person would also be researching the other options that are available and detailing what the pros and the cons of those options would be, what the costs would be associated with that. Again, so that we can come back with a comprehensive report for you. We also are looking for a half an FTE that would work with the vendors that has the technical expertise. So the vendors, somebody who knows about the vendors and the software and the types of questions they may have in relation to schemas and other technical pieces there that would be going on concurrently with the request for information. In addition to developing the request for information, somebody has to review those. There has to be meetings with the vendors to answer their questions. There has to be follow-up after the reviews are done, decisions that are made there. And then finally, we're just asking for a small amount of time from a communications resource that will help us pull all that together.
Just one final comment. I mean, just to work with the vendor, you know, the half an FTE, that means about 1,000 hours of time. And I don't see the... I see the need. I actually, you know, I know that there is a need, but when I look at how we develop, how much time we need, I think about that, and I think that seems too high. I just wanted to put that on the record.
Well, and Senator Gazelka, I was glad to hear you mention Senator Metzen, because we can just refer to his ever-present mm-hmm. conversation about we ask the department to do things, and it's always got an FTE attached to it. So I appreciate your comments. Senator Rest, anything else?
I would like for the deputy commissioner then to give her prepared testimony, if you will.
Mr. Steenbach. Ms. Steenbach.
That's okay. Mr. Chair, members, I would like to thank Senator Rest for bringing this bill forward. Like the senator, we have had requests to provide taxpayers with free electronic solutions for filing their individual income taxes, and we have researched what other states are doing in this area, and we have listened to taxpayers. Taxpayers are telling us they want a free electronic solution that does more than allow them to fill a PDF copy of the tax return and email it to us. They want a solution that works for all taxpayers and not just those who have a simple return with no worksheets, schedules, etc. They want a solution that makes it easy for them to file an accurate tax return, and they want a solution that does not require them to go to multiple different places to file a return. So with one spot to file their Fed and another spot to file their state return. In order to successfully administer the tax system, at a minimum, the department needs a solution that keeps the return filing process linked to the IRS modernized electronic filing process. And there are numerous reasons why we need to maintain that link that we have with the IRS. We need a solution that maintains the security and the safety of taxpayer information. And we need a solution that does not create an environment for filing of fraudulent returns. We need a solution that keeps up with all the state and federal tax law changes so that taxpayers can file a timely return. And we need a solution that's easy for taxpayers to use, resulting in a more accurate return that reflects the tax benefits that taxpayers are entitled to. We support this language because it provides the opportunity to research and recommend free electronic filing solutions that work for all those involved. This includes, the legislation does include requesting information from consumer-based tax filing software vendors and providing a report that gives you options and the estimated cost associated with the options that could be exercised to allow taxpayers to file for free in a way that's simple, effective, and meaningful, that allows the department to successfully administer the tax system and allows you to make a choice based on the options that are out there and the costs associated with them. We thank Senator Rest for bringing this forward, and we would stand for any additional questions.
Questions, members? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 2028? 1678. Anything else, Senator Rest?
No, sir.
Okay, thank you. Chair will lay Senate File 1678 over for possible inclusion. Thank you, Ms. Steen.
And Mr. Chairman, Senator, I would just say that it has been a real pleasure to work with Ms. Steenblock on this issue and some other individual income tax issues with regard to electronic filing. During these past couple of months, she's a true professional. It's been great.
And Senator Rest, I need to say that Senate File 1678 has
amended. Yes,
it's laid over for possible inclusion. So, I'll do. Senator Rest, Senate File 2028.
Mr. Chairman, Senate File 2028 is a response to. A current Department of Revenue policy with regard to how to tax the income of members of generally corporate boards who come to Minnesota for their meetings. Currently, there is a formula in place that allows the actual day spent at on, let's say, a single day at the board meeting to be considered as part of, to also consider the days of preparation to come to that meeting, because as you know, we don't, if you've served on any boards or groups outside of the legislature, and even here, obviously, as well, it's not just the meeting itself. There is a preparation time for it. And that is not the problem. The problem is that the formula that is used to determine the income of these non-resident board members is only allowed for those individuals who are members of two boards or less. If you are a member of a third board that meets in the state of Minnesota, you are only allowed that particular formula to determine your income by petitioning and getting a waiver from the Department of Revenue. We think that is an unnecessary step, and that regardless of how many boards you serve on, as a corporate boards that you serve on, that the formula for determining your non-resident Minnesota income should be identical. And so this bill attempts to do that. What happens if we don't do this? In my opinion, it will encourage corporate boards to meet outside of Minnesota because it's too big a nuisance to meet here. You might as well meet in Dallas or Las Vegas. It's not as complicated to figure out what your income liability will be in other places. And I think that we need to treat all board memberships the same, and we should welcome all boards, all corporate boards, because we have so many multinational corporations as well as others, to continue their meetings in Minnesota without the nuisance factor.
And Senator Rest, your concern about the mobility, you believe in this situation is real? The concern about the mobility of the...
Yes.
Okay. Questions of Senator Rest? Ms. Larson.
So I have two testifiers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members. Jill Larson with the Minnesota Business Partnership. Thank you very much, Senator Rest, for bringing this bill forward. And Senator Rest, I think, explained it extremely well. Of course, this bill simply, I think it will clear up some confusion that is out there around this issue right now. We know the Department of Revenue has a revenue notice right now that says that if you are on two or fewer boards, you can basically apportion your income based on the time spent in Minnesota. So you are paying tax based on the time that the board member is actually working here. And what this bill simply does is it essentially codifies that revenue notice, but also applies it to a board member regardless of the number of boards that they serve on. So it sort of makes everything equal and the same. And Senator Rest mentioned this issue about boards, companies not having board meetings in Minnesota, and that is a reality, and that is something that is concerning, especially when we have so many large companies headquartered here. It just doesn't send a great message to have them be having their board meetings outside of the state. So we fully support this legislation, and again, thanks, Senator Rest, for bringing it forward. And Dale Busacker from Grant Thornton's here with me to provide a little bit more information. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Larson. Mr. Busacker.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dale Busacker. I'm employed by Grant Thornton. Today I'm not testifying on behalf of the firm or on any particular client. However, over the last several years, I've advised many companies on this issue, and I certainly support Senate File 2028, and I want to thank Senator Rest for bringing this forward. I support using the time spent method because I believe that that's a fair method. It's clear, people understand it, and it's administrable. Time spent looks to where you spent the time doing the work. not assigning all that income to corporate headquarters. And it's similar to how the department treats non-resident employees. We first started talking to Revenue Department officials about this issue 3 years ago. And at that time, we were told that they would issue a fact sheet which answers many of the unanswered questions about how you, what their opinion is as to how you precisely allocate income of non-resident board members. To date, nothing has been issued on this matter other than the revenue notice, which the department allows the time spent method if you serve on one or two boards. What this bill would do is codify that method and would also then apply to all board members, irregardless of how many boards that you serve on. Petitioning the department is available for an alternative method. However, that's burdensome and it takes time. And people shouldn't need to petition. They should have a clear understanding, clear statement as to what the law is and how their tax liability is to be computed. And this bill provides that certainty without the need to petition the department. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Senator Gazelka.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And more comments than anything. I support this, but I also recognize that this is an area where some of these people have moved out of Minnesota, and they still want to participate and help in Minnesota. Somebody contacted me about a very, very similar issue related to venture capital and people not wanting to give money into Minnesota necessarily if that's part of the residency requirement. So it's kind of they're sort of woven together where, you know, this issue applies, but also residency is another factor that people have that live outside of Minnesota, and will that be counted inside? So I hope we continue to look at this. I asked Mr. Cummings to comment on that. I haven't gotten a comment back on that yet either, but it's sort of related to this. And so I hope we consider how does that apply as well moving forward.
Sure, and Mr. Cummings is on our list to testify. Any comments on Senator Gazelka?
Mr. Chairman, I do think, you know, I have bills dealing with the residency factors. This is not a challenge to residency.
No, I know
factors,
that.
Though. I mean, these are truly people who live and pay taxes in other states who fly in for a couple of days for these board meetings, and they could fly anywhere in the United States or even Europe, for that matter, for these meetings. So these are not this challenge is not one that would be a consideration for determining whether someone is a Minnesota resident. These are truly non-residents, and how do we go about it, fairly and consistently and predictably asking them to compute their income relative to their work on these boards that are done here in Minnesota.
Yeah, and Senator Mr. Zalka, Chair, the reason why
and I Senator
brought,
Rest, would you pull the mics up, please?
Sure.
And Mr. Chair, Senator Rest, the reason why I brought it up is some of these non-resident Minnesotans were, and they live outside of Minnesota 7 months or whatever the number is, and yet coming on board. So the income clarification I fully support, but also we need to recognize that that is a residency issue that some of them are concerned with as well. And so that's why I brought
okay.
it up.
Okay. Thank you.
Anything else, members? Mr. Cummings.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Sure.
Greetings, Mr. Chair. For the record, my name is Paul Cummings, and I'm the Tax Policy Manager at the Minnesota Department of Revenue. Thank you for the opportunity to be a resource on this bill. This bill modifies the sales factor under the apportionment formula to provide a special rule for compensation received by members of board of directors who are not Minnesota residents. This rule provides that these payments made to a non-resident board member of a board of directors of a corporation are sourced to Minnesota based on the proportion of time the board member spends in Minnesota providing board services. Minnesota Statutes 290.191, Subdivision 5J, outlines how any taxpayer who is a non-resident must apportion their income to Minnesota. This includes sole proprietors who live in another state but work in Minnesota, as well as large corporations who earn income inside and outside of Minnesota. Under this statute, this method is presumed to be fair. The right to petition the commissioner provided in 290.20 is the remedy for any taxpayer who does not believe that the statutory method of determining Minnesota apportionment is fair under the circumstances. When proposing an alternative method, they would have to demonstrate how it is more fair and ensures that benefits to professional board members does not appear to be more or less fair to taxpayers as a whole. To provide additional guidance for situations a taxpayer is serving on two or fewer boards, the Department of Revenue issued a notice in 2014. We issued this notice based on a request to allow an alternative apportionment method for board members. Those who sought this change argued that because board members whose service is limited to two or fewer boards function like employees of a corporation, it would be fairer to attribute their income to Minnesota like non-resident employees. Therefore, the revenue notice allowed anyone who meets the criteria to use the alternative apportionment method. We acknowledge that this is a narrow population. However, if a board member serves on three or more boards, the taxpayer's board activities are less like those of an employee and more akin to being in the business of serving on boards. In these instances where someone is in the business and less like an employee, they are subject to the same tax laws as all non-resident entities who generate income in Minnesota. They would do so as provided by existing statute. Mr. Chair, it's important to note that non-resident board members can receive a credit for tax paid to Minnesota on the return they file in their state of residence. The proposed language would move the taxation of non-resident board members farther away from other residents and non-residents generating income in Minnesota. We think the current revenue notice appropriately addresses this issue. Thank you, Mr. Chair and Senator Rest, for the opportunity to be a resource. We look forward to continuing the conversation on this bill.
And Mr. Cummings, reiterate again the difference between the two meetings per month and the more than two meetings per month. If it's three or more, they're a member of the business, or how did you state that? You said are in the business.
Right. Mr. Chair, it's the distinction is two or less boards, if you serve on two or less boards, and if you serve on three or more boards.
Three or more.
And under the current apportionment, if you are going to apply for an alternative apportionment under 290.20, we would have to try and see what is fair and what how can we treat you most similarly like other taxpayers. And what we believe that is that if you are serving on two or fewer boards, you are more like an employee, a non-resident employee of a corporation. But if you're serving on three or more boards, we think that you're really in the business of serving on boards. That's your job, rather than another employee. So we think that those should be treated like any other business entity and have their apportionment similarly treated as the apportionment of the corporation.
Oh, so in the business of serving on boards. Okay, I understand what your point is. I think we'll probably debate that a little bit. Senator Rest, did you have any further comments?
Mr. Chairman, I think that's a real stretch, I must say, that someone is in the business of serving on boards because they serve on four corporate boards. You know, why not three or few boards. I mean, what's magic about two to start with? And I just think the reasoning is faulty in my mind.
Questions, members? Anything else, Mr. Cummings?
No.
Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 2028? Seeing none, thank you, Mr. Cummings. Thank you, Senator Rest. Chair will lay Senate File 2028 over for possible inclusion. Senator Coonan. Senator Coonan, Senate File 2004.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Senate File 2004 establishes a school building bond agriculture credit, and it includes all Class 2A, 2B, and 2C property other than the house garage and 1 acre. And you'll see that in Section 1, Subdivision 1. Section 1, Subdivision 2, that deals with the credit amount, which is 50% of the property's net tax capacity multiplied by the school debt tax rate. And then in Section 1, Subdivision 3, is the credit reimbursements. The county auditor shall determine the tax reductions and certify that amount to the Commissioner of Revenue. The credit must be used to reduce the school district's net tax capacity based on property or based property tax. Section 1, Subdivision 4 deals with the payment. The Commissioner of Revenue will certify that the tax reductions for taxes within each school district to the Commissioner of Education, who will pay the reimbursement amount to each school district. And then Section 1, Subdivision 5 is the appropriation. A sufficient amount to make the payments required is appropriated from the general fund to the Commissioner of Education. Section 2 of the bill adds a school building bond agriculture credit to the list of credits used to determine net property taxes. And what that is gross tax minus the credits. Section 3 adds school building bond agriculture credit to the list of items shown separately on the notice of proposed property taxes, and you'll find that on page 3, line 24 and line 25. Section 4, the school district clerk must identify the portion of the levy that is levied for debt service at the time the levy is certified. Section 5, the auditor must calculate the school debt tax rate for each school district, and that's a school debt service levy divided by the total net tax capacity of all taxable property within the district. And then Section 6 deals with the contents of the tax statement and includes school building bond agriculture credit, and you'll find that on page 8, line 3 and line 4. And all six sections have an effective date beginning with taxes payable in 2016. And that's the bill, Mr. Chairman.
And Senator Coonan, so this is basically the state would pay approximately half of the school building levy on ag land.
That's correct, and that's class 2A, 2B, 2C, but again, does not include house garage and 1 acre.
Outside of the house garage and 1 acre?
Yes.
Good. Mr. Busselman.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. For your record, my name is Doug Busselman. I'm with the Minnesota Farm Bureau. Minnesota Farm Bureau supports Senate File 2004. We want to thank Senator Kuhn and the other senators who have joined together to bring this bill forward. We believe that there is a significant need to assist agricultural property taxpayers who are having to deal with high taxes coming from passage of debt bonds. Statistics indicate that many rural school districts, in many school rural districts, agricultural property taxpayers are shouldering a tax load of about 10 times the amount of others in the district. This bill helps to provide important relief on a time basis where we now are facing lower revenues from lower commodity prices. We believe that this is a very good bill from the standpoint that it's easy and simple. It also applies to those who are currently having the problem that they're having. It does not impact other taxpayer classes, and it maintains the revenue and financial support that's necessary for local school districts. We would urge you to consider the bill favorably. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Busselman. Mr. Schoenfeld.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Jerry Schoenfeld. I work with the Minnesota Soybean Growers, and since last fall have been working with a number of commodity groups, approximately a dozen of them, that have come together and taken a look at the property tax issue. Initially, a number of those groups were in favor of looking at some alternatives, exclusion for the house, everything except for the house garage and 1 acre, one of the proposals that you've seen, I think, before you before. But they came to realize that there were a lot of problems with that kind of a situation. And so they looked for an alternative that would deal with not causing shifts, because that was one of the problems, as had been indicated, and also the concept of dealing with all the indebtedness so that it was more fair. Some of the proposals that have been out there only dealt with things going forward. And so if a school bond was passed last year and is for the next 20 years, that was a problem, and this bill deals with that. So all I can tell you is that there are pretty much across the board, also sitting back, I think, in the audience, I was asked by Tom Peterson from the Farmers Union to indicate that they were on board with this as well. And so all I can tell you is that from an agricultural commodity standpoint, all the commodity groups generally are looking for something along this line, and both Farm Bureau and Farmers Union, as you've seen as well. So, Mr. Chairman, with that, I guess we'll stand for any questions.
Well, Senator Kuhn and I have seen some of the other proposals, and I appreciate the straightforwardness of this. And I see Mr. Peterson's here, and I understand he's supportive of this from Farmers Union, so that's good. Senator Gazelka?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And just for clarification, because I know we've been looking at different ways to solve the fact that ag lands have gone sky high, which means they're having to pay quite a bit more. My concern was particularly rural Minnesota that then wasn't passed on to the small business owners that already are second highest in the nation. And so this comes from the general fund then, or where does that money come from?
Senator Gazelka, I believe this would be state money that would be replacing the lost local funds.
Yep. Okay, thank you.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I understand the farmers are paying a lot of higher taxes right now as their incomes are coming down, and we have looked at different ways to help them, and so I appreciate that you're bringing this forward. But I just want to clarify, at least in my mind, that when you're talking that it's shifting to the state, and so that includes other taxpayers around the state who may already be paying for school debt in their local community. So I just kind of want to, at least that's my understanding, that and clarify that. So,
and Mr. Chair?
Senator Gazelka.
If I could make one comment to that, because when we look at the difference in school districts and what they get per pupil, most of these folks are going to be in very rural schools that are typically half the dollars per pupil as some of the larger metro schools. So I don't, if you look at total dollars being spent, if we're helping in this one small way, I don't think that's asking too much.
Senator Eaton.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess when you talk about there's not a shift, I'm wondering where we're going to shift this $50 million. A year from, if it's going to be from social services or school education or from senior care or roads and bridges, or this is a lot of money for one group of people.
Senator Coonan.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. And I'd like to comment on some of these comments that have been made, too. I understand that, I mean, clearly this is general fund money, and so the whole state helps to pay for this. But it's important to remember that a lot of these rural districts, the equalized aid that school districts qualify for buildings, in these rural districts with high ag land values and a high percentage of their property value is ag land, they don't qualify for any building aid, where other school districts do. And I think that's important to remember, that that aid is based on the property value in the school district and the number of students in the district. And so a lot of these districts they're very small school districts with not many students. And again, because of ag land values having gone up so fast and so far or so much in the last decade, they don't qualify for any of that building aid.
Senator Ertman.
Thank you. Well, Mr. Chair and Senator Coonan, it's not unprecedented what you're doing. We subsidize property taxpayers through the renter's credit and in other ways, and we do ask for general fund dollars to offset those expenses. So I don't think the approach is that unusual. It's new for farmland. But the reason, and maybe you can address this, that the property taxes are going up is because the valuation of the property has done so well. And so that's the challenge I have for you, is to say, well, we're doing this because they're doing well with their property values. So that's the harder part for me to get over. It's not that we've never done it before. It's just I just don't think we should subsidize farmers because their property valuations are going up.
Senator Schoenfeld, or Mr. Schoenfeld.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Ertman, I think you have a couple of things going on here. Yes, it's true that proper valuations have gone very high, but they've also gone very high, driven by a small number of people. And that the majority of the farms that are out there, there's two things. First of all, there's simply the fairness of the property tax situation in general as a tax, because of the situation that most commodity prices right now are at least a dollar a bushel under the profitability area, so that they're losing money and using up their equity. Secondly, property valuations, as you know, lag a couple of years, and so eventually things adjust out to some degree, but property valuations right now have dropped 8 to 15% in the past year on farmland, but that's a lag time, as you well know. And so I think it's a question of fairness also within how this particular property valuation is assessed, in the sense that you have a education in large part has been considered a responsibility of the state. And we have a situation where we have got, that happening with regards to operation and maintenance funding and so forth in that way. But in terms of schools, people in small communities oftentimes, one man, one vote, and yet at the same time there's an awful lot of difference in terms of what each individual pays towards that school building.
Senator Ertman.
Thank you. Well, I see this more as a cash flow issue for a business, where property values are up. That means you're going to pay a little bit more. There are times when you probably pay a little less because ag land isn't good. So I think over the long haul, it's really a cash flow issue. But I hear what you're saying about funding education. And that's where I'm frustrated in this committee, that we constantly are the workaround for what's not going well in the schools. So we have bills for tutoring, where we want to give tax credits for tutoring. We want to give tax credits for the teachers that are buying their own supplies. We've got all these tax credits to work around the problem of the K-12 system. And I almost think we should be having an education tax joint committee to talk about some of these issues. I don't think this is the most straightforward approach. if the schools aren't getting the funding they need and they're turning around to their local communities and their taxes are extremely high in order to get the same quality of schools in some of the other districts, that's the problem we should be addressing, and I wish we would do that instead of say we're going to have general fund dollars creating a different plan for taxing certain folks in certain communities. I don't think that's the best approach. Just I'm one, but I understand what you're trying to do and why you're trying to do it. Just don't think this is the most straightforward approach to the problem.
Senator Ortman, and I don't know if I want to get into this or not, but the only thing I would add is part of the issue here, it's not really as much related to the schools as it is to the amount of tax burden in relation to the income that they're able to generate. And as the tax burden gets to approach 25% or so of the income that can be generated off that acre, that's when these pressures build that they come and ask for some relief. And I personally think that this is a short-term issue and we should be looking for a short-term solution. And I don't know that we've found that today. But it's a struggle right now, and so I'm glad Senator Coonan brought this forward. It is much cleaner and simpler than some of the other proposals that we've seen. Senator Nelson.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And Senator Coonan, I understand the problem that this is addressing, and I think it's a real problem, a real concern, and I appreciate the approach that you've brought here. I do believe it's the most thoughtful approach that I've seen. And so there's a I tend to be supportive, but there's one element that we haven't talked about here yet today that I think cannot go unsaid. And that is, anytime we expand the requirements on the general fund, it does have to come from somewhere. And in this case, I look at specifically the statewide general business property tax. So as we expand uses of the general fund, then we have to find ways to backfill that, to fund that, those extra general fund dollars, and sometimes it goes for things like the statewide general business property tax, which is rather counterintuitive, I think, to this. So I think it's a good proposal. I think it's thoughtful. I like how it's sculpted. But I wish there was a better way than getting the general fund to backfill or to fund this. I'm just not sure what it is at this point.
Senator Dietzick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And again, I'm kind of thinking out loud here. We've had the other issues where because the ag values were raising so high that the county's CPA dropped and stuff like that. Can we get kind of going to what I think Senator Gazelka and Senator Coon said, can we get kind of like a map showing, or do we have data showing of where some of these property values have gone up so high so that the schools aren't getting and aren't qualifying for that aid, so we kind of have an idea of where we're looking at, and so maybe we can even target some of this, targeted, because it's not, I mean, values are going up in certain places everywhere, but if we can get a more targeted look at that, I'm just trying to think out loud to just kind of really, like you said, if it's a short-term issue, there's kind of the ebb and flowing, if we can get an idea of truly where some of this is really impacting people and then the schools.
And Senator Dietzick, I don't have it. I think there is a map out, and part of what the map shows is the higher the percentage of ag land in the jurisdiction, the bigger the problem. And so you're basically looking at an L down the western side and across the southern part of the state where it's, but, you know, as you move farther in toward the forest area, there's a more of an intermix of ag and other lands, and so the issue gets less pronounced. But I think that's around. I've seen it. Senator Dietzick.
I appreciate that's kind of where I assume it was, but, I mean, there are some larger towns in there that are they also being impacted? Or is it, you know, what size are we looking at? Because, you know, you have, I mean, maybe Wilmer is, maybe Worthington is, but you do have some what I would consider larger communities in that area. And so just I don't know what the impact is to them versus some of the other, I mean, maybe they're all, you know, joint schools now. I don't know.
And Senator Coonan, I know in some of the earlier proposals there have been that type of information available. Maybe we could see if we could find some of that and distribute it to the committee. Okay.
Yep.
Anything else, members? Senator Senjum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Senator Coonan. you know, we've had a lot of good conversation here. My plea is we don't give up on this on this issue, because it, you know, if you want to fill a gymnasium in maybe certainly southeast Minnesota or probably most agricultural areas of Minnesota, just have a meeting on property taxation relating to agriculture, and you'll fill your gymnasium real quick, and you'll hear a lot. And this is you know, this is a red hot issue out there. And you know, if corn was $7 or $8, that'd be one thing. At $3, it's another thing. And it may, as you say, Mr. Chairman, be a sort of a floating kind of temporary thing. But it is red hot right now, and I think we have to try to react to it in the most studied way that we can. And at least this is an approach that I think, as you and others have said, it's understandable. It's you can argue whether it's reasonable or not, but we need to deal with this, and I hope we can continue the conversation and discussion.
And Senator Senjum and members, I'm not saying this because I'm not going to continue forward with these other proposals, but part of our conversation around this issue this year has been, it probably would be worth a while for us to go back and have the department revisit an issue that they have studied a couple times in the past, which is changing the value of ag land to a production-based model, which would be more reflective of what is actually going on out there, and I think would solve some of these issues. And I'm not suggesting that as a replacement for any of these things, but I think it's something that we should contemplate, so that it not maybe next year or the following year we could actually have some information and see if that's something that the state could contemplate doing. Senator Ortman.
Mr. Chair, to your point, I can see why that would be an improvement for these farmers in the ag land with the income generation. But I also think real property is an investment and it accrues in value. And so somehow you have to capture that increased valuation as well. And so it would have to be some kind of a hybrid of what we've got now, adding in also the future of the measurement of the income off the land.
And Senator Ortman, we do have alternative models of valuing businesses. Malls have sales and rent as part of their component. These tall skyscrapers have part of their business model as their valuation component. So we do have models where we do something different than just you know, the sales ratio. So I think it's worth taking a look at. Anything else, members? Anyone else wish to testify on Senate File 2004? Thank you, Mr. Busselman, Mr. Schoenfeld. Thank you, Senator Coonan.
Thank you.
No amendments. Chair will lay Senate File 2004 over for possible inclusion.
Next bill is Senate File 1227, Senator Skoit. And Senator Skoit, you have an amendment that you want to offer as a author's amendment, and that would be the A1.
Yes, Madam Chair, there's the A1, and this gets the bill so it will conform with the revenue estimate.
Senator Skoit moves the A1. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. Senator Skoit, Senate File 1227.
Madam Chair and members, I'm here with Senate File 1227 as amended, and I think I'm going to have most of the conversation carried by Mr. Lund. But this bill does make four changes to the Allied Charities gambling provisions that we have in the state. It moves electronic link bingo from combined receipts to a flat 8.5% tax rate. It exempts the first $50,000 of those organizations, so they would be the same as the exempt organizations are today. Raises the combined receipt triggers from $87,500 to $100,000. From $122,000 to $200,000, and from $157,500 to $300,000. These all have revenue impacts, which I am going to bring up as a concern in that they have the potential to negatively impact the funds available for paying off the Viking Stadium, so we're going to have to resolve that, and if that is the case, we will probably not be moving forward with any of these provisions if that is an impact. The fourth provision in this bill has to do with the audits, and hence we're joined by Gino Fragnito from the CPA's organization. We are trying to see if there's some middle ground where we could save some of these organizations some of their costs on audits by using some of the work that is being done as in inspecting them by the Gambling Control Board as a replacement, but we're not complete. We haven't completed that work yet, but that should be part of our conversation this morning. And so I think, Madam Chair and members, I'll turn this over to Mr. Lund to walk through the bill and explain some of the purposes, and then you know, we can have questions on that. And I'd like Mr. Fragnito to have some opportunity to comment also.
And Senator Skoy, this is going. You'll be going through the bill as with the as amended. Is that correct?
Yes, Madam Chair. We're working off the amended
and the
bill.
Fiscal note. The revenue estimate is drawn to the amendment.
It's drawn
the amended
to
the, language.
The amended language, yes. Madam Chair.
Okay. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Alan Lund, Executive Director of Allied Charities of Minnesota.
Mr. Lund.
Thank you. And we would first like to start by thanking the author for bringing this up for discussion, and we sincerely appreciate that. The Minnesota charities today are hard-pressed to get money to the bottom line for missions. With our expenses and the tax rates that we pay, the money that gets to the bottom line is very much welcomed, appreciated. And what this bill does is offers some ideas on how to help us to get more money to the bottom line. And starting with that is moving the electronic link bingo from the combined receipts rates, which it was placed in when it was brought into existence, to the regular paper bingo rate of 8.5%. Currently today, the state gets about $11,000 a year in taxes on electronic linked bingo. It has not caught on how we all had wished it would. We do see it as a tool that we believe is a tool that is going to become more important as time marches on. As an example, our electronic pull tabs is now our third largest business out of seven legal businesses for charitable gaming. So we believe that if charities have an opportunity to make more money paying the 8.5 versus the 9, 18, 27, and 36% combined receipt rates, that more of them will look at that as a vehicle for raising money for missions. The cost to the state on that would be about $22,000 for the biennium. The first $50,000 tax-free is when we look at our exempt counterparts, the charities that can raise money through charitable gambling but are not licensed, they can hold up to five events a year and make up to $50,000, and they pay no taxes on that money. Licensed charitable gambling contributes about $45 million to the state, and we would like to be considered for that same benefit as our exempt counterparts. And that would be about an $8 million cost for the biennium to the state. Raising the combined receipt triggers, the $50,000 really helps it helps all charities, but specifically the small charities. The raising of the combined receipt rates really helps the bigger charities who spend most of their fiscal year in the 36% rate. And that 36% rate is pre-expenses. We do not get to deduct any of our expenses. So typically a charity, about 50% of the money that we get to take to the bank goes to expenses, but we pay that 36% rate on every dollar that we take to the bank. So it's a pretty big rate. So we weren't looking to change those rates. We were just saying we'd like to take longer to get to that trigger. And that does have a cost of about $20 million for the biennium. And the last issue that we were looking for is currently nonprofits by statute are required to have an annual, by the Attorney General, to have an annual audit if you have $750,000 in revenue. Charitable gaming is somewhat different, that we give back 83, 84, 85% of what we take in before our patrons even leave the door. So we're working with the 15, 16, 17%. $750,000 in revenue to us is as little as $130,000 in banked money. And I'm not making light of that, but a charity that only banks $130,000 a year is in real money that they can use to pay bills, taxes, and missions, also is required today to have that annual audit. So we are up against a Gambling Control Board compliance review every 18 to 24 months. We are subject to IRS or Minnesota Department of Revenue audits at any given time. At any time that they wish to call that, they can do that. And we have examples of where charities, through strictly a random, the luck of the draw, have had a compliance review, the annual outside audit, an IRS, and a DOR audit all in the same year. That is a tremendous tax on resources, both physical and financial. So currently our bar for that audit is 5.5 times tougher than it is for the for a Minnesota-based nonprofit. All we're saying is we would like to be considered to be treated as all other nonprofits in this example. Some of the charities that are at the very top end of what we do are the, I'm sure where I want to get to it, I can't. I'll have to get back to that. So, Madam Chair, that's basically the gist of the bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Lund. Senator Scoy.
And before we go to Mr. Fagnito, Madam Chair and members, the reason that I'm carrying this bill is because I recognize that after all the prizes are paid and all the expenses are paid and, you know, all the taxes are paid, there's left with a relatively small amount that goes to the work that we would really like them to accomplish. In my hometown, they have helped fund the fire department, and they've helped support other community, you know, important community activities. And if there was a way to save some of money, and if there was a way to reduce some of the burdens, it would just add to what they can put into the community. And as we heard with some of the earlier testimony today, you know, we have communities. It's a lot of the work is being done by volunteers. Some of this is paid, of course, but you know, it's for these smaller towns, it's always a challenge to keep these things going. And if we could leave a few more resources around for them to do things in the community, I just think it would be a real good thing. And so, hence the effort that we're trying to work forward on this.
Mr. Fagnito.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Gino Fragnito, and I'm here today in my role as a employee of the Minnesota CPA Society. I also am a public member of the Charitable Gambling Board, and my comments today are not reflective of my position or activities in that role. And I would first like to start out by commending Allied Charities for looking for ways to maximize their contributions back to their mission statements, and that's something that my members, when they're working with these organizations, are also looking at ways in which they can possibly streamline operations, look for efficiencies, and maximize the returns. But I would like to highlight a couple things that in Senate File 1227, as amended, that it would create a separate audit requirement for a subset of nonprofits that my members certainly would work with, but I would note that making the change would certainly add a little bit more complexity to the tax code. Not something we couldn't work with, but want to highlight that. I'd also bring you back to 2009, where In the 2009 tax bill, the audit thresholds were raised from $350,000 to $750,000, and that's consistent with the Attorney General requirements. That also coincided with the increased reporting requirements on the IRS 990s, which now asked for significantly more information from charities than was previously asked for. So there is additional information that's out there with those. When we talk about the $750,000 in revenue versus the $750,000 as it would be defined here, we'd be creating a modified net revenue, which would take into account prizes paid. And just doing some quick math, if I look at, I'll use 80% as an average payout for an organization, we're up to about $3.7 million in gross receipts. So that's a number that I think we need to consider and look at. I think that there are ways to look at increasing efficiencies and providing some of the public protection, but also ways to help the charities make sure that they are returning the maximized profits and money back to their missions.
Are there questions or comments for Senator Skoy or Mr. Lawn or Mr. Magneto? Senator Ortman.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Senator Skoy, when do you expect to have that analysis regarding the impact to the Viking Stadium funding?
Madam Chair and Senator Ortman, we are working with the department, and hopefully it's coming shortly. But it is an issue. And Senator Ortman, hence I'm paying particular attention to it.
Senator Dietzick.
That was my question.
Senator Marty.
Mr. Chair, Madam Chair, Mr. Fragnito, what level, the audit level, where should they be kicking in?
Mr. Fragnito.
Mr. Chair, I think that the $750,000, when it was discussed back in 2009, was consistent with what the Attorney General required, and then also with the added requirements of the 990s, provided some assurance to those that are consumers of them and those that use them that that was maybe the amount that was sufficient.
But, Madam Chair, with the change from whether it's $750,000 in gross receipts or versus net receipts, I mean, that's like you're saying $3.7 million would be if we changed it to that?
That's just a rough math.
Is that an appropriate number, I guess, is my question.
Madam Chair, Senator Marty, I guess the appropriate number I would leave up to the legislature, but I think if you look at what the $750,000 is versus how we have it defined in this bill, the amount also may not be the same every year for an organization because there may be a year where they have a different payout and different sales. So that's also a moving target that I think that needs to be factored in the discussions.
Senator Skoy.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Senator Marty, I'm not interested in relaxing the audit requirements for any organization. I just don't believe that that's good things for us to be doing. I am interested in finding ways, if we can get the same information through some other mechanism that they're already doing, perhaps we can accomplish savings and still get the information. And so, members and Senator Marty, what my hope is, we are trying to set up a meeting with the CPA organization, the Gambling Control Board, DOR, to sit down and work through the audit requirements to see if we can actually come up with something that would save some money that they're already doing. But I'm really not interested in weakening the audit requirements of organizations. It's not my goal.
Madam Chair, Senator Skoy,
Senator Marty.
My hope would be about the same thing. Yeah, you want to make it simpler and not have them do three or four things, but not loosen it up. Just make sure we get it in a more efficient way.
And Madam Chair and Senator Marty, I listened to this conversation and even the testimony this morning about having the Gambling Control Board and the DOR and all, and you know, I mean, there must be something there that we can be doing to try to make that simpler and streamlined, but still get all the information that's needed.
Further comments or questions for Senator Skoy or his witnesses? Is there anyone else who wishes to testify on this bill. I do see Mr. Barrett in the room. If anyone has a question of the Gambling Control Board. Seeing none, the chair will lay over Senate File 1227 as amended for possible inclusion in the omnibus tax bill. Senator Scoy?
The note is laying. There it is.
For the hearings next week, we are planning on meeting every day to process members' bills, a few studies, and omnibus bills that we get from the finance divisions, like the education bill or transportation bill, come through the tax committee. Senator Ortman.
Madam Chair and Senator Scoy, when do you anticipate the rollout of the tax omnibus bill?
Senator Scoy.
It'll be before the end of the month. We are working on that currently. We'll try to keep the members as informed as we can. I think the Senate's goal is to get these finance bills processed in the coming week, and the tax bill will follow.
Thank you.
Anyone else? Seeing no further business before the tax committee, stand adjourned.
Thanks.
You too. All right.